Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for joining us today. For you that don't know me, my name is Anthony Bibolo. I'm the Research Director here at the Lowy Institute, and it's a great pleasure to have you here join us for this special In Conversation with Hayden Cooper. We at the Institute have a number of missions, but one of our most important missions is to broaden and deepen the conversation about foreign policy and international policy issues in Australia. We realise, however, that this is not something we can do on our own, and that we need to work with other institutions and organisations and professions in that mission. And one of the most critical professions in that mission is, in fact, journalism, and particularly those journalists that focus on international affairs and their elements of that profession that find themselves out in the field, the foreign correspondents. It's something that we have been focused on for a while, something that we've been concerned about as financial pressures have forced media organisations to shrink their international coverage, to shrink the number of foreign correspondents overseas. And in fact, our concern about that prompted us a couple of years ago to found the Lowy Institute Media Award as a small way to recognise the work of Australian journalists working overseas and to encourage media organisations to keep Australian eyes on the world. We're very lucky to have with us today the winner of last year's Lowy Institute Media Award, Hayden Cooper, who's just come back from a stint in the Middle East. Hayden won last year's Media Award for his reporting on the Peter Grest case, and that's something we'll talk about today. As is usually the case in these kind of conversations, Hayden and I will chat for a while and then I'll open the floor and take some questions from you all here. Just some background on Hayden. So Hayden was the ABC's Middle East correspondent from late 2013 until early 2015. He was based in Jerusalem. He covered events across the region, reporting from Turkey, Lebanon, Israel, Gaza, Jordan, Saudi Arabia and Egypt. As I mentioned, his coverage of the Peter Grest trial won him the Lowy Institute Media Award. It also won him some other prizes like the Walkleys and the Logie, but, you know, they're not that important. He also won a Walkley Award for his television and radio coverage of the 2014 war in Gaza. Hayden has previously reported for the 7:30 program in Sydney and spent 6 years as a political correspondent based in the Canberra Press Gallery. He's been at the ABC for 15 years, and Hayden's now back with 7:30 Report. Correct. So welcome, Hayden. It's great to have you. Let's start by talking a little bit about your time in the Middle East. What was the job? What were you meant to cover? What were the, where were you based and where did you travel? Just kind of set the scene for us.
Sure. Well, thanks, Anthony. Thanks for having me. It's nice of you all to come. It was pretty much everything. The job was based in Jerusalem, as you said, and the task really was to be across everything happening in the Middle East from Turkey down to Egypt and across to Iraq and Iran. So it kept us very busy, obviously. There were two of us there. And before I start, I should also say you'll hear me referring a lot today to we and us and talking about our experience. And you should know that the very first thing I learned about most of the news correspondents in the Middle East, most of the Australian ones, in fact, all over the world, was that there's always someone smarter in the background behind the actual correspondent. And in most cases, it's their partner, their husband or their wife. In my case, it was my wife, Lisa Main, who's actually here today, and she is actually a much better journo than I am and did a fair bit of writing for Lowy.
At least write it, really.
We should. We swap while we were over there. At different times, she was my sub-editor, my chief of staff, my safety advisor, and I know that was the case for all the other Aussie journos in the Middle East as well. It was certainly something worth learning. For both of us, I think we could say that reporting from the Middle East is essentially a journo's dream. The stuff that's going on there is always top of the world news agenda. So it was an amazing experience being there. Essentially, my job was to file for every ABC radio and TV outlet and also online. So the biggest part of the job, I think, was filing for AM most mornings back here, and then moving throughout the day, 24-hour TV news, the 7 o'clock TV show, 7:30, late line, foreign correspondent, all of that. The structure and the time zone effectively means that you're at your busiest at the end of every day in the Middle East as Australia is waking up. So it meant a lot of nights sitting at the kitchen table banging away on the laptop. The postings, well, my posting was rather neatly bookended by the arrest of Peter Gresta somewhere near the start of it, and then thankfully the release of Peter Gresta towards the end of the posting. So I spent a lot of my time shuttling back and forth between Jerusalem and Cairo for the trial and the aftermath. And as you say, Gaza was one of the other big events that I covered and that impacted me in my job and most of the other journos who were there at the time. In between, I guess you're covering everything that's happening, whether it's the rise of ISIS, covering it from a distance, from as great a distance as possible, whether it's other events like the Israeli occupation, whether it's the standoff that rears its head every once in a while between Hezbollah and the Israelis up near the Lebanon border, the refugee calamity from the Syrian war, and then a few quirky Australian angle assignments thrown in, like Gallipoli for Anzac Day, and Saudi Arabia going there for all reasons, but for a football match, would you believe? So all in all, an amazing time, fascinating, full of colour and movement.
Before we talk a bit about some of those episodes, and I wanted to start with the Gresta case, but is this whole, you know, some people say, well, does it really matter if we have Australian foreign correspondents? There are lots of international news organisations, you can pick up wire reports. Does it matter that we have Australian eyes on the world as opposed to American eyes or British eyes or French eyes for that matter, or you know, any other eyes? Do you think it matters?
Yeah, of course it matters. It does. And obviously I would say that. But it's one of the things that the ABC has traditionally done well, and I'm very thankful for the chance to have actually had to go there. You know, it doesn't mean that every story needs to have an Australian element. I think that's a big mistake that a lot of journalists make and a lot of news organisations make, and I hope that that's something that the ABC doesn't fall into. Sometimes that's the driving factor in why we travel to places to report. Most of the time, though, it's not. And the good thing about the ABC is that, thankfully, we're still there to cover everything. And there is still an interest in those stories from ABC programs and I think from ABC audiences. So, yeah, it's very important. And there's only, what, three Australian journalists based in the Middle East. The Australian newspaper, Fairfax, and the ABC. And the ABC has two, in fact. So there's not a huge representation there from Australia. Most of the other media organisations fly in, and I think their coverage often is not as good as a result because you need to be there.
So to the Gresta case, obviously a case that resonates, you know, for you, he was the case of an Australian journalist, albeit not working for an Australian media company, working for Al Jazeera, who finds himself imprisoned in Egypt. Before we come to the particulars of the case, help us kind of set the scene, because obviously the arrest of Peter was not kind of an isolated, and Peter and two other Al Jazeera journalists, and we shouldn't forget those, and we'll come back to Baha and Mohammed in a moment. The arrest wasn't something that occurred in isolation. It was part of a broader series of events in Egypt. So set the scene for us a little bit about what was happening at the time.
Yeah, look, we'll get to this, but I think it was more about politics than press freedom, the arrest of these three Al Jazeera journalists. And although the press freedom cause is now being taken up with great vigour by a lot of people around the world as a result, and that's a good thing, It wasn't the reason they were arrested. This was about the Egyptian dispute with Qatar, which owns Al Jazeera. But to set the scene in Egypt at the time, it's a very tense place, and it's back to what it was. The Muslim Brotherhood is gone from power. You've got a new dictator in President Sisi. And the lead-up to their arrest, it was already very clear that Al Jazeera journalists were in a place of danger. Their offices had been raided, several had already been arrested, and so it was quite clear that there was some sort of serious political dispute going on in the background. And for that reason, I think Al Jazeera probably has a lot of questions to answer about why they sent Peter Grester in and what sort of safety studies and preparation they did before that happened. My first trip in to Egypt in the posting was actually about 3 weeks after Peter was arrested with his two colleagues. At that point, it hadn't really registered as a big story for us to cover, maybe because of my own failing, but it wasn't quite clear at that point how much trouble these guys were in. And it wasn't until the charges were laid and they were terrorism charges that we finally got an idea of that. But 3 or 4 weeks after the arrest, we went in to report actually on the constitutional referendum. And we had actually arranged to interview various critics of the interim military-backed government, people from the Muslim Brotherhood. And we were due to go and see them on that first afternoon. In the end, we're very lucky that that didn't happen because we decided to put them off to the next day and instead went around filming some parts of Cairo, posters of Sisi and so on, that sort of thing. And in an extraordinary act of my own naivety or stupidity or probably both, we decided to start filming just across the road from a police checkpoint. And it gave me a very quick and early lesson about the power of that security state because it took about, you know, 2 or 3 minutes before we were pulled over to the police. They made us stand on the side of the road for about an hour before a couple of plainclothes guys came along, jumped in our car, took us down to the police station. And by this point, I was starting to think I would end up in the cell next door to Peter. What they wanted to do was to look at our footage, and thankfully there was nothing on our camera at that time that would get us into trouble. The chief of police in that local district went through everything we'd filmed, had a look at what we'd done, saw all the CC posters and so on, and decided to let us go. From that point on, Every trip I took to Cairo, I was paranoid and sometimes afraid that what we were doing and the reporting we were doing would get us into trouble. And so we were very careful from that point on.
Well, it's quite it's obviously Egypt's gone through quite an enormous change over the last 4 years. You know, even under the Mubarak regime, it was a reasonably liberal place in terms of press freedoms. International press could come and go. Occasionally, papers would be taken off. Newspapers would be taken off the newsstands for a couple of weeks or banned for a while. But basically, it was it also had a fairly vibrant domestic media. After the uprising, it became even more vibrant in a sense, where it did become a bit of a free for all. But a lot of that has now been clamped down on. Some would argue, in fact, it's now more restrictive than it was, you know, before Mubarak was overthrown. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the state media is almost all there is in Egypt. There's not many independent voices because either they are just not willing to speak out anymore. It's not safe for them to do so. And one of the sad things while we were there was interviewing some of these young revolutionaries who saw so much promise and had so much hope a few years ago, only now to have it dashed. And a lot of them have retreated, and I don't know if we'll see them coming out onto the streets again. In fact, I don't think we will. But all of them, they all say to us, and we interviewed one guy who in the protests of 2011 first had one eye shot out by the security forces, so lost one eye, then 6 months later had the other eye deliberately shot out, so he's completely blind, but now quite openly accepts that their time for the moment has passed. And so operating as a journalist there is extremely difficult, and the troubles kind of begin when you turn up in the country and go to the press office to try to get accreditation, which you have to do. And the first way they try and control you is they don't issue you with a press permit. You even though you've given them a lot of notice and you say, we're coming to report on the election or whatever, you'll inevitably turn up to that press office in downtown Cairo. They'll say, yeah, go and sit on the couch. And you'll sit there for 2 or 3 hours. Everyone's reasonably happy. There's a lot of staff because they're all paid very cheaply, but nothing happens and there's never a press permit forthcoming. So you then, as a journalist, are confronted with a pretty tricky question. Your organisation has paid for you to be here, so you feel like you have to do a story, right? But you don't have the permit to do it. So what do you do? Do you put your tools down and wait and hope that in another day, if you come back, you might get a permit? And Greg Wildsmith is here today, who's one of the ABC's best producers and came across for that foreign correspondent piece, and knows quite well what I'm talking about, because it gets to the point where you're on the phone to the head of the press centre, as he was, saying, we need these permits, you knew we were coming, and they still don't materialise. So what it then means is that what the approach we took is that we still needed to report, we still needed to do the stories we were sent there to do, but you have to do it really carefully, and that means always being very careful about where you go, who you interview. And we still did interview critics of the government, but when we did it, we kept it very short. We would do it, for example, in our van, even not in the street, and we very rarely actually just got out of the van and filmed in the street, because, as you know, Egypt is a very suspicious place, and if there's not 10 policemen on every corner, which often there is, the members of the public actually come up and call you out, and you're from Al Jazeera, you're American, and you have to get around that. So it means that the coverage we can produce is limited. Mm. You still can do it, but you've got to be really careful.
So turning to the Gresta case, I mean, what for you was the most difficult aspect of bringing that story to life?
Well, personally, the most difficult aspect was walking into that horrid courtroom at Tora Prison and seeing Peter behind a cage with Muhammad and Baha Muhammad. That place is like hell on earth. It's a godforsaken place. It's sort of about 20 minutes from the middle of Cairo. It's a really dusty, dirty, huge, sprawling prison. And what you have to do is we arrive at 8 or 9 in the morning. There's a massive road right next to it with, you know what the traffic is like, you're really sort of risking your life to cross it to get in there. And then what would happen inevitably in each of the dozen or so court hearings is we have to wait outside on the footpath, and eventually we're let in inside the prison. You go through all the security checkpoints. You're meant to give up your phones and everything, but eventually we were able to take them in. And then you get to this waiting room outside the courtroom itself, and it is such an awful place. The bathrooms are overflowing with sewage. Of course, there's no bathroom for women. It's full of police and security forces and lawyers who are there to defend their clients. And then finally you get let into this big courtroom, which you probably all saw, with the cage, and the journalists were all behind the cage. The first day I went, I had no idea what to expect, and kind of thought, you know, it's a court of law, here we go, let's see how this turns out, and very quickly realised that it was an absolute circus, and there was no reason to the decisions of the judge or the prosecution case.
Some pretty ridiculous evidence that was presented.
The evidence was bizarre. I mean, that first hearing, they went through all the materials that they had, the so-called evidence, and it was, two phones of Peter Gresta. He's a bag that he had and a laptop. Oh, there's a memory stick and a camera, all the stuff journos would naturally have. And it only got worse through the trial, playing the stuff off his laptop, some of his work when he was actually with the BBC, playing the wrong clips, so playing Sky News Arabia footage instead of Al Jazeera. But despite all that, the case went ahead. It got to that final awful moment of the verdict, and bang, there it was, 7 years. And that judge, Mohamed Nagy Shahata, is a menace. Since the Gresta verdict, and we didn't really know of his reputation at the time, but since the Gresta verdict, he has sentenced more than 200 people to death, mostly in mass trials. He's sentenced more than 230 people to life prison terms, and most of them are protesters or activists, journalists, people who were helping with media at the Rabah Alawiya Mosque for the Muslim Brotherhood. So they're all political cases. But at the time, we didn't realise that man's reputation. And what's clear now is that he's serving a purpose for the regime, and that is to deter anyone from going into the street and deter any journalist from really telling things independently and accurately. Sure, a lot of his cases are overturned on appeal, but by then the damage is done and he's served his role.
One thing that came through very strongly, both in your own reporting but also in the general reporting, was the very dignified and principled way in which both Peter, but he's also his family, kind of comported themselves in this. I mean, that obviously came through very strongly in your own interactions with them.
Yeah, they were amazing. Eurus and Lois, the parents, I only caught up with them once in Cairo, and poor old Eurus was incredibly sick from eating the food there, and they were really up against it. It was after the verdict, and I can't imagine what they were going through. And then Peter's two brothers, Mike and Andrew, who were sort of taking turns in spending a month or two in Cairo at a time. They were incredibly dignified throughout the whole experience, and so was Peter. And I could never quite believe how well this guy just kept himself together every time you would walk in to the courtroom. And for a start, it's just a really bizarre thing for a journo to walk into a courtroom and sort of wave at the defendants. But that ended up being the role that we all played, and it's just something we felt we had to do. And but he was always quite chipper, Peter. He was, always positive, very quiet. He's got a very quiet voice, so we found it hard to hear what he was saying. His colleague, Mohamed Fahmy, was really the enforcer of the group, often shouting out, speaking very clearly, and that's continuing today. He is the only one of the three who has called out Al Jazeera for their role in the way that they could have done things better. Epic negligence, I think he describes it as. And he's continuing to do that. And he was doing that throughout the trial. He hired his own lawyer, whereas the Gresta family and Baha Muhammad's family went with the Al Jazeera lawyer. So Muhammad's definitely going on his own path. But all three of them were very dignified, and it was a massive relief when Peter finally got out.
And we often lose sight, the focus is on the Australian journalists. We lost sight of the two other journalists, say Baha Muhammad and Mohamed Fahmy. I mean, what's happened to them now?
They're still there. They're on bail and the trial is going on. There's a little bit of hope maybe for Mohamed Fahmy to get the same deal that Peter Gresta got, because he's Canadian, this law allowing President Sisi to deport foreigners. So that's one option for him. But Baha Muhammad, it's a lot more difficult because he's an Egyptian citizen and simply has to go through the process. One can only hope that common sense will prevail eventually and that they will be cleared. And this is another reason why Peter, I think, has been reluctant really to get into the politics of that situation since his release, because he knows that his colleagues are still on trial, and actually his name is still on that charge sheet as well. So, yeah.
Against the background of the awful news from Indonesia overnight, there is this whole question that I know came up in the Gresta case about the role that the Australian government should play. And, you know, this whole question, and as a former Australian diplomat in the Middle East, I know it, although I was never there when we had an Australian in prison, there's always that question about how do you approach a consular case? Do you take a kind of a low-key, you know, kind of out of the public eye approach that hopes not to aggravate the situation or to push people in the corner, or do you do a kind of a high-profile, you know, kind of almost public shaming campaign? Obviously, in Indonesia, the government, you know, took, you could say, possibly a combination of those two approaches. Unfortunately, it didn't work. How would you judge the government's performance in the case of Peter?
I think it was very good. I know that the Australian Embassy in Cairo had essentially put all other business aside. This was the number one and only issue they were working on for a lot of months while he was in jail. And they seemed to take that softly approach publicly, which was understandable. Yet behind the scenes, Ralph King, who was the Aussie ambassador there, was just taking every opportunity to raise this case at an international level, to the point where we had a friend inside DFAT who was saying that he was at a conference with Ralph King in Cairo. It was actually about Gaza, rebuilding Gaza. And the ambassador would, and did, at the end of it, just march up to John Kerry and tap him on the shoulder and say, just remember about this case and raise it when you can. I think it was the only issue they were really dealing with. And I think they did do a very good job. You've really got to be careful about issuing demands or ultimatums to, I guess, any Arab government, but especially Egypt, because it, you know, it pushes them into a corner. And I think that's why I think the Australian government initially was very careful about the comments they were making in public. In fact, throughout they were. And they started talking about it more towards the end of the case, and that's why. And another example is that I think around about the day of the verdict or the day after, the White House came out very publicly and said this is a draconian sentence and the president should pardon these men and let them go. A very strong public statement was made. Within 24 hours, President Sisi had come out, given a speech, and said, "We won't pardon them." You know, there's probably many different views, but I struggle to see how it would help to really put that strong view on the table when it's all about domestic politics for President Sisi. And the fact is that Al Jazeera is viewed very badly in Egypt. Journalists, full stop, and foreign journalists, especially, are viewed very poorly. So if you look at it in terms of his own electorate, he was always going to play that card and wasn't going to be pushed into doing anything quickly.
Now, if you spend any time as a journalist in the Middle East, you're invariably going to cover some kind of conflict, some kind of military, some kind of war. You did that in the case of the Gaza conflict. Obviously, one that's in that particular situation is very close to home. You didn't have to go to Gaza. As you know, rockets are being fired at Tel Aviv. I don't think any made it to Jerusalem where you live, but you know, in effect, you're part of the story itself. Tell us about that experience.
Yeah, that was quite something. And rockets did come out to Jerusalem, and we had the air raid sirens a few times. And Lisa had to cope with that most of the time when I was either in Gaza or running around near the border. That was incredibly busy. It got a lot of coverage, rightly so, in Australia, I think, and especially on the ABC, despite coinciding with some other big international news events like, I think, Ukraine, that sort of thing. But our approach, of course, was to tell the story from both sides of the border, which is the only way to do it. And it meant that initially, when it all kicked off, I went straight into Gaza. For there's probably many people, including yourself, who've taken that unusual, bizarre little trip in, where you go through the Israeli checkpoint at Erez, then you go through this strange, mechanical, personless kind of entry point. Doors just automatically swing open for you after you've been given the Israeli clearance. You walk through a long tunnel about a kilometre long with a cage around you. And at that point, there was a lot of mortar fire going on. It wasn't necessarily directed at people coming in, and you could never be certain which side it was coming from, but there was always the boom of shells going off all around. So it was very tense. But you walk all the way through this tunnel and through Hamas checkpoints on the other side, and there you are. And initially, when we went in, I was in there for about the first few days and reported on that side of the conflict, and then came back out. And my colleague, Matt Brown, went in, and I stayed on the Israeli side for a little bit. And essentially what you're doing is, it's very difficult to cover from the Israeli side because obviously you can see and hear what's going on, but you're not necessarily there. But we split the roles very evenly. So if you're on the outside, it's your job to chase the rockets and interview the Israelis who are affected by this. If you're on the inside in Gaza, obviously you know what the job is. So it was a very tense time, and it's a sort of story where you have to be very careful about being fair, about presenting both sides of the story, and that went on for a month or so. I went in again much further into the conflict, about 2 or 3 weeks later, and the first thing you notice is the human toll of this war. 2,000 Palestinians dead, 70-odd Israeli soldiers killed, and the absolute blanket devastation, which by then was obvious everywhere in Gaza. And we, for example, went to one little township called Kuzar, which is just near the border with Israel, and it was like a tsunami had rolled through the place. It had been completely smashed to smithereens. A lot of people had been killed in that part of Gaza, and that was still probably a few weeks before the ceasefire finally worked. And it was just interesting following the process through the fact that they tried many times to have a ceasefire and rarely did it work. There was not really any will on either side to stop the attacks. Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and all the other Palestinian groups clearly thought that they had got nothing out of it at that point, so kept lobbing rockets over, and the Israelis kept responding. So it was really quite a tiresome and difficult war to cover, but thank God it eventually ended. Mm.
And what are your kind of hopes, expectations for whatever ceasefire that resulted lasting there? Do you see it that we're again going to be back into that kind of situation of another conflict in Gaza?
It always seems inevitable. I mean, this has become a once every 3 or 4 year thing. And the question will be, I saw some reports very recently actually showing that the Israelis were starting to open that border a little bit more, let more trucks through to rebuild, let a bit more trade through, which could ease that tension a little bit. But it's not as though it's going to end that threat once and for all. It might kick it down the road a bit.
Yeah.
It's become the situation where, as I say, every few years this explodes. And last year was one of those ones where it really did explode, and it was the most violent year in that part of the region since the Second Intifada. And beyond that, even before the war in Gaza, there were almost weekly deaths of Palestinians in the West Bank at the hands of Israeli forces. There was also the kidnapping of the Jewish teens and the killing of those three Jewish teenagers, the retaliation, burning alive of the boy Muhammad Abu Qadir in East Jerusalem. It really was a very tense time. And that continued after Gaza as well, with the synagogue attack, with people driving cars into groups of Jews at tram stops. It was quite tense, and you got the feeling, living in Jerusalem at the time, that anything could happen. There was a lot of talk about whether this was the start of a third intifada, and it was very difficult to predict what would happen. At this point, it seems to have settled down a little bit more, but I see no solution there. I mean, the idea of a two-state solution to me is just fanciful. I don't see how it could happen. We had the Prime Minister Netanyahu's comments before the election saying it won't happen on his watch. Sure, he's tried to walk those comments back since, but I think there's reason to be sceptical about that. And you see very little will from the Palestinian side for a long-term solution, or at least very little agreement between the different factions in there. So, I don't know, that's a loss. Throw into that the settlements on top of many hills throughout the West Bank. This is something that is very difficult to undo.
It's often difficult to think of journalists as human beings, but it's true that some. But it's true, in fact, that some of them are. Tell us a little bit about. I mean, you know, you weren't a fly-in, fly-out correspondent. At least, you're not. You know, coming from Australia, you're flying around the region. You're covering something like Gaza, and in fact, you're kind of living it, or you're going to Egypt to cover, you know, the Peter Gress story, which obviously has some emotional resonance. You know, you're going to Lebanon, talking to refugees. How do you, come back and detox from that at the end of the day? What do you do, in effect, to keep yourself sane?
We drink. We are journos, no.
Great Australian tradition, yes.
No, we don't. Sometimes we do. Look, the thing is that a lot of people, you were one of them, you said to us before we got there, you've got to get out of the Middle East every couple of months, and we didn't listen to you. And what we found, and I think I can speak for Lisa as well, that the first 10 months or so, we stayed in the Middle East through all the trips to Egypt, the Gaza war, which added that extra level of tension, and we made the mistake of not making sure we got out of the region every couple of months, which is something you absolutely have to do. So by the time we did, we went over to Europe and just breathed out, and it was quite a bizarre experience leaving the place, and it makes you feel quite sorry for the people who can't leave and have to live through it permanently. But there are just some amazing light times as well, and you meet some incredible people, and there's an incredible sadness there, sure. Mostly what we found the hardest was the little kids running around in the Bekaa Valley in Lebanon, this little Syrian refugees who've lost everything and have nowhere to go and aren't even going to school. That was very difficult to see and to interview them and report on it, but then walk away without doing anything. You know, it made you feel quite guilty and privileged. So the suffering obviously stays with you, and for me, it's that, and it's some of the suffering that we saw in Gaza, and it's also the anxiety of the situation in Egypt with the threats to journalists and Peter Gresta and so on. You take the good with the bad, and it was really an amazing experience. You learn a lot. You can't properly understand the conflict, the situation there, without being there to experience it. Mm. And the people over there are amazing. They're beautiful people all over the place, and it was good to meet them all.
Hayden, you've covered a number of really big stories in the Middle East. You talked about some of today, the Gress trial, the war in Gaza, Syrian refugees, the rise of ISIS. But I want to come now to probably the most important story that you covered in the region, the Western Sydney Wanderers' victory in the Asian Cup final in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia. That must have been a surreal experience. Tell us a bit about that.
That was very strange. So I really wanted to go to Saudi Arabia, and I didn't care that it was a football match. That was actually easier than going to do some other story undercover. But what happened was I got a call, and I wasn't really following this football competition, the Champions League, I must say. Got a call from my boss.
Seemed like a nice guy anyway, but anyway.
Got a call from the bosses in Sydney. Can you get a visa to Saudi? This game's on Saturday night, and So over we went to Amman in Jordan to get a visa. Obviously, we have two passports. One has the Israeli stamp in it. The other is used for many Arab countries, which don't like Israeli stamps, as you might imagine. Over there, I managed to get this visa. So we fly into Riyadh for a soccer game. And
football. Thanks.
Football. Sorry. Depends where you come from. So we get in there, and one, I was thinking, this is great, we're in Saudi Arabia. And we start, you know, we find where the team is staying and pretending I'm a sports reporter and pretending I'm, you know, trying to make sense of what's going on. Then I got a call, and I hope she doesn't mind me telling this story, but my old boss, Sally Neighbour, who was the executive producer of 7:30 and is brilliant, and I'd do anything for her except this, because she called... She called as I was at a press conference with some soccer player, and she said, listen, and this was Saturday, she said, listen, I want a story for Monday night about the oppression of women in Saudi Arabia. And I thought, oh dear, here we go, how do I get out of this one? And I tried very hard, and she said, look, tell it from the angle of the one Australian woman who's gone over to this match to watch it, and she was the only woman in the stadium because women aren't allowed to go to the football there. So there were 60,000 blokes watching the footy and one Australian woman. And anyway, so we ran around trying to do this story and quickly realised how difficult it is to film anywhere in Saudi Arabia. Let alone to walk up to a woman and say, are you oppressed? but I tried hard. I ended up, we met some great local
guys.
Probably
not the first question you should ask, but anyway, yeah.
Probably not. So we met a great bunch of young guys, and they're all incredibly smart Saudis. Well, you know, most of them. A lot of them are educated overseas in the UK or the US, and I managed to arrange to hang out with these guys late one night in Riyadh, and they picked me up, took me to some place on the outskirts of town, and I had no idea where we were or where we were going, so I quickly emailed Lisa a map of where I was, thinking, where are they taking us? I didn't know these guys. Anyway, it turns out what they were doing was just all these men, they leave their wives at home and they go and play video games together. in a little flat that they have on the outskirts of town. And so I found myself in this room sitting on the floor playing video games and smoking the shisha. And that sort of went on for a few hours and managed to... They were great. You know, they were all very, very smart and willing to be interviewed, very careful about what they said on the issue of women's oppression. Namely, they said, look, the king, he wants to change things, he wants to let women drive. That will happen, but it has to happen slowly, which is the line you often get there. But eventually, left, went home the next day, just realised that I just could not tell this story without any Saudi women in it. And I ran up the white flag and said to Sydney, I'm sorry, I'm here to cover a football match and that's all I can do. So I went to the game, and one of the best moments was we were at this football match but got dropped at the wrong part of the stadium. And our car was, everyone was quite good-natured, but they realised there was this little group of Australians and among a crowd of 60-odd thousand Saudis. So they started rocking our car a little bit and we sort of scurried in, but realised we had to get on the other side of the stadium. We weren't quite brave enough to walk back out and around, so instead they escorted us across the actual football pitch. And the whole crowd, it was me and Ken Sutcliffe and these other sport journos from Australia, the whole crowd was booing us the whole way around as we walked across this massive stadium.
I'm sure that was just like, because I recognised Kenny Sutcliffe.
Probably.
Time for some questions from the audience. Let us know who you are and who wants a question, and we'll bring a microphone to you.
Tony Dowling, retired radiologist. Julie Bishop's report yesterday about the ISIL being the biggest danger to world order. What do you think of that?
Well, at the moment, you would have to agree, wouldn't you? I mean, This was one of the bigger stories we had to cover there, the rise of ISIS and the way these little nutcase criminals are running around chopping off heads. The threat that they are placing to the Middle East is obviously clear. The threat that they pose here in Australia is less clear, and I think we don't yet know enough about where that ends and what happens with any fighters who try to come back and those who are yet to try and head over there. So obviously, I think it is one of the biggest issues that that has faced the region for a long time. From our perspective as journalists, it's very difficult to cover, as you probably know. We were restricted, really, in telling that story from safe places. And when I say safe, I mean, you know, on the other side of the Syrian border in Lebanon. We spent a week there doing a story about the threat that ISIS is actually posing to Lebanon. And one of the views there is that Hezbollah is the only reason that they have stopped at the border. And it's arguable, but these guys we were hanging out with were saying that, look, Hezbollah is strong, they'll never come into Lebanon. The other way we were covering it is my colleague going into Erbil in Iraq and doing it from there. But there's very little that journos in the region can do to get in there and cover that story properly, and it's a great shame. I'm not volunteering, but yeah, it's just that was one of the disappointments, having this massive security issue unfolding and not really being able to get close to tell the story.
Peter Timmons, Hayden, any observation about Australia's intervention in the Middle East and our perceptions of us? I mean, is there any separate identity, or are we all caught up in the bigger world and not very visible?
Look, we're not very visible. In the sense of the fight against Islamic State, no, I don't think we are very visible. We're playing a role. You know, some people might say it's a token role. Others would disagree, but it is a role. I can only speak mostly about the way Australia was viewed during my time there in Israel and the Palestinian territories. And it was a very interesting time to be there, because it was at the moment when George Brandis appeared at a Senate committee and decided that East Jerusalem is not occupied. I think he said it's disputed. After he said that, that was something that got a lot of traction in the West Bank. And certainly I noticed that often we would be in the West Bank and find people would say, hello, welcome, where are you from? And we'll say, Australia. And I say, oh, you don't like Australia. And we would say, yeah, well, you know, it's politics, it's difficult. And usually they would say, well, you're welcome, you're fine, it's your government we don't like. So that definitely had a noticeable impact. And I think, you know, in the months afterwards, it seemed as though Julie Bishop was trying to, walk those comments back a little bit. But still, Australia at the time was viewed, along with Canada, as the most ardent supporter of Israel.
Hi, my name's Philippa. I have a question about what news source or which news sources you found useful to kind of stay abreast of the entire, you know, all the different issues going on throughout the Middle East, and also whether there was any disconnect between what you as a reporter on the ground found very interesting and worthy of reporting on and what the actual Australian public responded to, or what got ratings back home and what your producers wanted.
The news source, if I can call it that, that most people operate with these days as a first point of call is Twitter, depending on who you follow. And if you do follow reliable people, obviously, it is very handy in finding out developments and what is happening at any given moment. And actually, during Gaza, it was a pretty vital tool, again, depending on who you follow, and you have to be very careful. Because I did notice a lot of things on Twitter which were not true. But it is a very handy tool that journalists were using at the time. Beyond that, obviously, we pay for agency wires as well, and that's something that all organisations rely on in their reporting. The second part of the question is interesting because I always found it a great shame that often we would struggle to get the interest back here in Australia on the Israel-Palestinian conflict. There seemed to be a level of tiredness with that story, and instead, at least from executive producers at the ABC, a lot of interest in the ISIS issue. It was much more timely. It was the new threat. And so that is one that always generated a lot of interest, especially any Australian involvement, obviously. But Israel-Palestine had fallen off until Gaza happened. And sadly, the war in Syria, you know, it's still raging. Hundreds of thousands killed. But because it's been going for several years, it's very difficult to get the attention it deserves from any given news or current affairs program.
Hi, I'm Venus Kalesi from the Australian Baha'i Community. I guess I have a question from a personal interest point of view. To what extent do you think your reporting helped with Peter Gress' case and his release? And also I'm interested to know what would be your assessment of the consciousness of journalists worldwide in reporting these stories, not from a professional perspective, but from a compassionate perspective, in helping to put the sort of international pressure on through the media for these unjust imprisonments?
I don't think my reporting had any impact at all on Peter Grester's case. If anything, I worried that it would have a negative impact because so often it was our job to describe the injustice and exactly what was happening there. And I often was quite worried about reporting in my own honest opinion about that trial and about the judge and about the sham of a trial that it was, but did so anyway, and more than a few times remember doing live reports and I guess condemning the trial, speaking very strongly about it, but then worrying who was watching this feed that I was speaking of on, you know, whether there were Egyptian authorities monitoring the news that was going out. That was a big concern, but I think, in effect, I really don't think that the Australian media's reporting had a lot of impact on what happened in the courtroom. Yes, it helped to boost, I guess, the attention on the case, and eventually that worldwide pressure had some impact on the government and President Sisi, but it took a long time. The other part, look, because you see injustice everywhere, there are times, like the Gresta case, like when you're reporting on Syrian refugee kids, there are times when you really do inject a lot of your own feelings or experiences in what you have seen. But the reality is that most stories that you're covering in the Middle East are about politics, and you have to be very careful to be an independent observer, and that is something that we always try to be, especially on the story of Gaza, for example. And again, there, you know, there were times when I was very blunt about some of the things that we saw inside Gaza. But because it's all politics, you've got to be very careful about it. So I think it's rare for journalists to really inject themselves into stories, and that was something I found very difficult with the Peter Gresta case. But I don't think there was any other choice.
Let me finish with a looking back at the Middle East, the region you've just left now. Obviously, there's a lot happening. It's not just the rise of ISIS, kind of the Syrian conflict, the kind of still lingering tensions and questions around the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the situation in Egypt, Yemen, Libya. You know, it's difficult to remember a time in the region's modern history when it was more disordered, what seemed more disordered than it is today. I mean, when you look at the region today, what are your kind of fears and hopes? I mean, what are the one or two things that make you really worried about what will happen in the region and its broader consequences from the world? And what are the one or two things that give you some cause for hope about the region's future?
For hope, not much, to be honest. I don't see any solution in sight for the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I don't see any solution for the Syrian civil war. I don't necessarily see how this issue of ISIS can be properly countered and defeated, at least in the next 5 years. Now we've got Yemen and the power play between Saudi and Iran. I have no idea how all of that will play out. I think the Middle East will forever be the place where journalists always have a story to report on. And, you know, it's the one thing I noticed about going there compared with working, for example, in Australia, where you have to scrap around looking for a story. It takes time and it's very difficult. Over there, there are so many stories running at you that you just got to pick which horse to jump on, you know. And I don't see how that is going to end.
On that happy note, Hayden, it's been a pleasure to chat with you today. Please join me in thanking Hayden Cooper. I will see you all next time.